We have our song with Maddy Pryor, called The Name of Arthur. And in the song, she is harking back to the idea of a 4th, 5th century war leader or king at the heart of the story of Arthur. So I'm going to talk, before we go on to work with the she cards, I'm going to talk a little bit about Arthurian myth. And the complications of it. In your pack, there's a thing that says, one side says components of the tradition and the other working with the tradition. So I'm going to look at this part that I called components of the tradition. Because when we're looking at Arthurian tradition, we're looking at something very complicated. And when Phil and I were chatting earlier, he was talking about Arthur as a palimpsest, which is a kind of medieval document that gets written on time and time again. So there are lots of layers. And one of the reasons why we're looking at the Arthurian myth as a way of exploring the collective psyche is that it contains within it, in that palimpsest form, this compressed layers of history and human experience in this land. And in a certain sense, if you look at the bottom of the diagram, it begins with relating to the living land. So in this case, the living land is where we're living. It's Britain. If we were looking in a different part of the world, we'd be looking at a different mythic tradition. But the thing about the collective psyche, some are bridges between the universal and the local. So there is a whole process by which aspects of collective experience become picked up and become nodes of influence or centers of influence within the kind of collective soul. And if you just think back into collective history, just immediately we come into the wars, the Second World War, the First World War. So you can see it even within current time. There are these images that are organizing images that subsist within the collective kind of psyche and within the sense of the energetic atmosphere of the land that we live in. So this, when we apply ourselves to any locality, one of the things that we start to come into relationship with, if we start to inquire in this way, is stories, images, living history that somehow remains underneath the surface. When we, we're doing this in Glastonbury, which is a sort of, in its own way, a mythic place, with lots of, that certainly over the last 50, 60 years has acquired lots of new myths, lots of new projections. I mean, this idea that some people in town will talk about Glastonbury being the heart centre of the world, which is an unusual thought, but if you look more deeply into Glastonbury, it has been a pilgrimage centre, a sacred centre, somewhere that connects everyday life with something bigger and deeper. And you can take that right back into the lake villages of Glastonbury and Mere that were kind of ritual centres way back along. And so what you see is a sort of a living history. Now, so when we start to look then at Arthurian tradition, we start to look at a tradition that comes out of the British Isles, what's called the Matter of Britain. There are lots of, when you start to think about it, there are lots of images, there's loads of texts. And as you engage with the images and engage with the images and the text, you start to penetrate more deeply into this kind of collective inner world. So in a certain sense, so in Melkert we have the living land. In the Esod, we have the living images that arise out of the Arthurian stories. In Hod, which is the place of the mind, we have all the texts. All the massive amount of scholarship has gone into studying the Arthurian myths, and you can get very easily lost in that. And sometimes you can discover amazing things. But what you also have, as you explore this tradition, is what I've called daemons, which are the sense of the living spirits or spirits that, and that's partly what we're going to look at when we look at the she cards. Where we look at the sense of, we start to come into what the 17th century writer Robert Kirk would call the secret commonwealth. A sort of underneath the surface of the land, the surface of what is known, you start to come into a more fluid world where there are beings who exist within the inner traditions and the inner life, inner soul of this land that talk back to you. So the daemons start to talk to you. As you engage with this much, much more kind of deeply, you start then to become the grail seeker who hopes to be the grail keeper. So this is in Tiferet. This is the place where you are searching for the light, and as you search for the light, you find and continually lose the light. So you're both the seeker and the keeper of this mysterious shape-shifting thing that's called the grail. And where that takes us into, really, is that deeper place where you have the goddess of the land who challenges anyone who seeks to penetrate more deeply into the land. So she's there as a kind of a Gebura figure and traditionally she is the goddess is the figure who confirms the king. So it's in the Arthurian myth, it's the Lady of the Lake who gives him the sword. You know, it's in some of the older traditions, it's the goddess Morgan, who is the head of the nine sisterhoods of Avalon, who challenges him and keeps not as an evil thing, but challenges the king to be the king, challenges him to pick up his sovereignty. And so we, alongside the goddess of the land, we encounter this ancient image of the once and future king that comes out originally out of very tribal ideas, but gradually coalesces in this myth into the figure of Arthur. Now at a deeper level, we start to come into the place of Da'at. We start to come into the living ideas that are behind this whole mythic structure. And these ideas are constellated around this sense of a fiery hope. And in the little song by Maddy Pryor, where she talks about this the bare bones of a story of somebody who fought against anarchy, who protects and enables order, peace, civilization to develop. So there's a constellation of ideas here that are the root ideas out of which all this generates. And then when we come into the deepest part of the tradition, really, we come at that center point is the spirit behind the grail, this sense of that which does not regenerate is not the grail. So that sense of the constant regeneration of life. And arising out of that regeneration and resurrection energy is the will to be, the will to express, to live, and this deep love that arises out of being, the love that shapes, that creates forms, containing forms, that enable that will to incarnate itself. So this is the sort of, if you like, the internal structure underneath this vast and historic complex tradition. Now if we turn over the page, then what I've looked at on the tree is, well, working with this tradition. So that's the component. This is the thing we engage with, we're going to be engaging with. And so if we come from the top down now this time, so what we're doing is engaging with that spirit of the grail, which is in this resurrecting energy. We come into communion with all those who work with this tradition through time and in space. So the field, so the sense of this being a corporate work. So as we enter into this work, we become part of the circle of the Grail initiates, engaging with the Grail. So engaging with that will to generate, to regenerate, engaging with the tradition itself, which is the thing we're going to explore. And out of this, we look at the arising, we'll be looking continually at the arising of new impulses, which create new iterations of it. And what that takes us into in the middle is the mystery of the sword, the mystery of the cup, and the mystery of the Grail Mass, which is the coming together of the sword and the cup, the coming together of opposites, the generation of new life, which emerges in the development of new story, new understanding, new images, and hopefully and finally the renewed land. So these two tree diagrams really give us a sense of, the intention is to give us a sense of, okay, this is the deeper structure of beneath all the stories. Working with this, and the purpose of working with this is this, is to return to that sense of the mysterious regenerative energy that is represented by this shape-shifting thing called the Grail, to enter into communion with those who are working with this and that tradition, and then to enable a new impulse and this mystery of the coming together of the cup and the sword in the Grail Mass, that is the meeting of opposites and the regeneration of the new story, new understanding, new image, new land, new action. Yep.
Something. It seems to me, thinking of Glastonbury for the moment and think about Tudor Pole and his three maidens and actually finding the blue bowl.
Yeah.
It seems to me that these top bits, they were working with all this until it came down to the Grail Mass, which is what they actually celebrated in Bristol.
Yeah.
And there it seems to have stopped.
There it stopped there, yes, I know. It's curious, isn't it? There's something did get stopped there somewhere, so it didn't produce. Well, it produced within limited circles, but it didn't much move beyond that. And so
it didn't infuse the wider land.
No, it didn't. No, so it's somewhere we ended up contained, and it's an audit reiteration of this, in that the blue bowl that used to be freely available every Thursday in Chalice Well for people to sit with is now locked in a bank vault. And available only to very few people. So there's something about the way that impulse didn't ground itself, didn't earth itself.
Some people might not know the story.
Yeah, let me just tell you a little bit. So what Penny's referring to is that in one of the iterations of the Grail myth, the person who created Chalice Well was a man called Wellesley Tudor Pole. And
created as it is now, but it was Alice Buckton before.
Yes, I know, but he created the inner structure of it. Alice Buckton didn't really have a lot to do with the Grail myth. She was doing something else.
Anyway,
I don't want to give a lecture on Glastonbury history, so that you can look it up. Anyway, there was this man called Wellesley Tudor Pole, connected with Chalice Well, who has written a whole number of quite interesting books, really, that in the 20th century about the his idea of the Grail, and what was the name of the man who put
Goodchild?
That's right. An associate of his, a man called Goodchild, had a vision that he should, and he had this very beautiful blue bowl that I think comes out of Venice or somewhere, but anyway, he believed this bowl to be the chalice of the Last Supper. But anyway, he had a vision that he should come and hide this bowl in a bride's well, which is just outside Glastonbury, and then I think the vision was a Holy Virgin would come and find it and so. The sister of Wellesley Tudor Pole has a vision about a chalice hidden in a stream outside Glastonbury, And now we don't know the detail, we don't know if this is true, but this is the myth, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. So they go off and they find the blue bowl, and they believe they found the Holy Grail, that they actually have found the Sun Grail. Take it back to Bristol with them, and then they start to do prayers, ceremonies, grail masses. And latterly, this becomes held within the Chalice Well Trust. And you used to be able to see when we first lived here, you would go on a Thursday night to the meditation evening, and you'd sit with the blue bowl. And at the end of the evening's meditation, the blue bowl would be passed around, and you'd sit and you'd contemplate it, and then it would all, you know, it's a rather lovely meditation, really. But there's a way in which, and the point that Penny was making is that the way in which that became quite contained. It was a powerful thing, but it was like a secret thing that didn't really sort of percolate very far into the world. And in these days, in fact, you can't even have access to the blue bowl. Imagine the trustees of the trust take it out on special occasions, but it's no longer available. But it's a good example. Hmm? Yeah.
Can I mention another thing? I think it's two interesting things. The first thing, the Grail Mass, the ceremonies they set up were directed by priestesses, by the three women.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, we come down to Holt here in scholarship,
yeah.
And they actually, it was postulated that it was the genuine Grail.
Oh, yeah, no, it was ridiculous. Yeah.
The top people in the Church of England got involved in this, and were quite credulous about it. And yeah. It hit the newspapers, and it sort of became a literal thing, and I think that's what killed it.
No, I think it is, because it very clearly does not come out of first century Palestine, Jerusalem. It's a beautiful, very beautiful object. It does have quite a luminosity. If you hold it, you do feel you're holding something very special. But it looks to me like a really nice example of Murano glass from Italy. And he found it, and Goodchild got it from Italy, bought it in an antique shop in Italy. And he believes that it had come from Jerusalem, but I don't. But I think it was probably made in Italy.
If the Grail's constantly resurrecting and changing,
yes,
then you couldn't make it a bowl, could you?
No, definitely. Well, that's the whole point. It's not a thing. Yeah. You see, once it's become so that the Grail spirit, you could say, could infuse any object. So any object could be the Grail, and then the next moment it would be gone. Anyway, that's the point. And I think that almost a literalism that happened there, yeah, I suspect was part of the thing that in somewhat killed that impulse in a certain way.
The archetype,
yeah.
It sort of loses
it. Yeah, it does. It loses its shape-shifting quality in that case, really. And so, if we come back to kind of just coming away from that particular story, if we come back to just because I just want to give you a bit of a flavour of the Arthurian story, because Arthur also has this same shape-shifting, mysterious. Kind of the thing, and in the Maddy Prior song, the singer, the Arthur figure, there is complaining that he's been made into a thing. It was actually, when we think about Arthur, we think about that whole tradition that has within it the sense of the restoration of order, and then the having restored order, the finding of this mysterious quality called the Grail, which destroys the existing order. And creates something new in its place, and that's one of the root principles that you find in this tradition. And in fact, Tennyson, in one of his poems called "The Idylls of the King," talks about the destruction of Camelot as being necessary, and he has this lovely line: "Lest one good custom should corrupt the world." And it's that way in which good ideas, if they become fixed, if they become unavailable to change, inevitably become oppressive ideas. And with Arthur, if we think about the roots of Arthurian tradition, so what you find are stories that are in, that I'll read you one or two of the Welsh poems in a moment that refer to this from the Black Book of Carmarthen. called the Black Book of Carmarthen, because it's got a black cover, not for any more mystical kind of meaning. Actually the Welsh books, the Welsh medieval books, you have the Black Book of Carmarthen, the white Book of Rhydderch, the Red Book of Hurghost, and that sounds really kind of magical and mystical, the mystical colours of the goddess white, red and black. Actually they are simply called like that because one's got a white cover, one's got a red cover, one's got a black cover. That's why they got their acquired those names. But the what you see there, you'll see there are poems referring back to a figure probably from the 4th, 5th century. But the only manuscripts we have are 9th, 10th, 12th, 13th century. So we have a written down tradition pointing back at a figure. The very earliest reference we have to Arthur is in a poem written by the bard Aneurin about a great battle called the Gododdin. And the Gododdin is a battle that happens just outside Edinburgh, whether it's the great battle of Cattraeth, and the great 20th century writer John Jakes wrote a wonderful but graphic novel called Men Went to Cattraeth about this battle where most of the heroes are killed, and Aneurin, who's supposedly an eyewitness to this great battle, makes a reference to Arthur because he talks about one of the heroes, and what he says is, but he was no Arthur. And that's the only reference that we have, that he was no Arthur. Now, the Gododdin is supposed to be a very early poem. However, the manuscript we find it in is a 9th century manuscript. So, rather like the Druids, rather like we have nothing in written sources from that is contemporary. But we have a whole load of references back to a being. Now, I'm just going to read you some. This is from the Black Book of Carmarthen. So let me just find the stanzas. So here is a poem called Arthur and the Porter Having a Conversation. So I'll just read you a little bit of this because it gives you a flavour of the territory. But remember that this is talking about something. This is the manuscript in which this is written is hundreds of years later than the events it's pointing back towards. What man is the porter? Glywed Galavur. Who is the man that asks it? Arthur and the fair Kai. This is the conversation now. How goes it with thee? Truly the best way in the world. Into my house you shall not come unless you prevail. I forbid it. You shall see it. If with night were to go, the three would be unlucky. Mabon, the son of Modron, the servant of Uther Pendragon. Kisgaint, the son of Bannon, and Gwyn Godimbrin. Terrible are my servants, defending their rights. Manawaddin, the son of Clear, deep with his counsel. Didn't Manawaddin bring perforated shields from Troyred? And Mabon the son of Mecht spotted the grass with blood, and Anwast a Dainog, and Chloch Sanawag, guardians were they on either Cymmyniog. A chieftain that patronised them, he would have his will and make redress. Kai entreated him, while he killed every third person when Cechli was lost. Cechli was found and rejoiced. Kai, as long as he hewed down, Arthur then distributed gifts. The blood trickled down in the hail of Wavnach. Fighting with a hag, he cleft the head of Payach. In the fastness of Zithach, in Mynydd Aiddin, he contended with Cynfyn. By the hundred there they fell. There they fell by the hundred before the accomplished Bedwyr, on the strands of Troywyd, containing with Galarwyd. Brave with his disposition, with sword and shield. Vanity were the firmest men compared with Kai in the battle. The sword in the battle was unerring in his hand. They were staunch commanders of a legion for the benefit of the country, Bedwyr and Bridlau. 900 would to them listen. 600 gasping for breath would be the cost of attacking them. Servants I have had, better it was when they were. Before the chiefs of Emrys, I saw Kai in haste. Booty for chieftains. Was Gurhi among the foes? Heavy was his vengeance. Severe was his advance. When he drank from the horn, he would drink with four. To battle when he would come, by the hundred would he slaughter. There was no day that would satisfy him. Unmerited was the death of Kai. Kai the fair and Llachai. Battles did they sustain before the pang of blue shafts. In the heights of Ystfygion, Kai pierced nine witches. Kai the fair went to Mona to devastate Llewon. His shield was ready against Orth Palug. When the people welcomed him, who pierced the Cath Palug? 90 before dawn would fall for its food. 90 chieftains. Just reading another one. And here we have Arthur's dialogue with an eagle. I wonder, seeing I am a bard on the top of the oak and its branches on high, what is the vision of an eagle? What the illusion? Eagle. Arthur, who has attained distant fame, joy and advantage of your host, the eagle has seen this. Arthur, I wonder at your station by the side of the wall. I will ask of thee in meter, what the illusion, what the vision of an eagle? Eagle. Arthur, your fame has travelled far. Your host is of a gladsome aspect. The eagle has seen this. Arthur. Eagle, being on the top of the oak, if you beest of the race of birds, you can't be either domestic or tame. Eagle. Arthur, gladial potent, before whom as onset nothing stands, I am the sot of Madoc, son of Ithara. Arthur, I know not the kind of eagle that frequents the vales of Cornwall. The sons of Madoc up Ithara liveth not. Eagle. To meditate unrighteous treason and conceal your purpose long is called complete sin. Arthur, eagle, gentle in discourse, speak thou without reserve. What shall enable me to escape? Eagle, pray for God at every dawn. Seek to obtain remission. Ask the aid of the saints. Arthur, eagle, not poor in speech, I will question you on discourse. Of what sort is the worst that happens to sin? Eagle, to obtain the long penance infernal, get an irrecoverable fell, and lose God to eternity. Arthur, eagle of speech about to support, I will ask of you, is there a course devoid of hope? Eagle, Arthur of exalted eloquence, if you would obtain a share in the world with the mighty, hope is weak. Eagle, Arthur of speech subtle and fierce, whose host is unreproached worth. Eliwyod, Erwell was I called. Arthur, eagle of blameless aspect, whose discourse is not evil, are you Eliwyod, my nephew? Eagle, Arthur, audacious in the onset, if I be Eliwyod, am I a good connection of yours? Arthur, eagle, untreacherous in discourse, if you are Eliwyod, was the battle slaughter good around you? Eagle, Arthur, audacious in answering, before whose face no enemy stands, from death there is no support. Arthur, eagle and disguised of speech, no one could through war bring you to life again. Eagle, Arthur, dignity among the generous, if the words of the canon shall be revealed, with God contention is not good. Arthur, eagle clear of speech, will you say unto Arthur, what thing is evil for him to do? Eagle, to purpose evil with premeditation, to abide long in the purpose, is called sin and failure. Arthur, eagle, most wise in discourse, of thyself will I inquire, how shall I attain to God's approbation? Eagle, love God with a righteous mind, ask upright requests, this gives heaven and the mundane gift. Arthur, eagle, veracious in declaring, if it be correct, I will ask you, is the praising of him good in Christ's sight? Arthur, you are the most mighty, on the tower I will expect the excellent hero, let every spirit praise its Lord. Eagle of serene existence, without intrusion, I will ask you, who does the spirit say is nearest? Arthur, restless with blades, was fallen by the pain of your bloodshedding. Christ it is, whose faith is not concerning falsehoods. Arthur, eagle, speak words of acknowledgement, I will ask, while I cry out, what is the course to seek for heaven? Eagle of celestial destiny, have you not obtained to see what Christ does to those who believe? Arthur, Gwythion of gladness, with your host you have a complete huntsman, yourself shall know the judgment day. Arthur's exalted, swiftly moving lamp, each one shall know its place. If you seek the service of the Son and favour with God after, with God afterwards, blessed are you by that reason. Eagle Arthur, eagle condescending in discourse, by the concealed God I ask of you, what shall be mine if I shall be without it? Eagle, if you will have unveiled discourse, you are the Son, until no other Son appears. Eagle of no trivial discourse, I will ask you in all security, what is the course of my soul? The parter and the prayers, fasting and charities, calmness of your soul till death. And now something called the stanzas of the graves. I'll just read some because there's lots of them. The graves which the brain bedews, men were not accustomed to afflict me, carried and coiroed and cow. The graves which the showers bedews, men that would not succumb stealthily, are Gwyn and Gwyrion and Gwyriod. The grave of Tidyne, the father of the muse, in the region of Bronarran, where the grave makes a sullen sound. The grave of Dullan in Llanbaino. The grave of Kerry Gledhir in the region of Heneglois, in the rugged steep place, Taru Torment in the enclosure of Cobre. The grave of Sethanin the weak-minded, between Cae of Kenodrev and the shore of the great sea and Kinneran. In Aber Gwenoli is the grave of Pryderi, where the waves beat against the land. In Carraug is the grave of Gwalaihir. The grave of Gwalchmai is in Perithion, where the ninth wave flows. The grave of Canon is in Llanbadan. The grave of Rin, the son of Pede, is by the river Egered, in the cold place of the earth. The grave of Canon is in Rhydreion. The grave of Llawllagarnan is in the river Cefddin, the head of the Saxons of the district of Erbyn. He would not be 3 months without a battle. It goes on and on and on. Because it's a bardic thing. So it has many stories coming out of all this. Each one of these things has a whole host of stories.
And all of them, what I love about it so much is that it's all, once upon a time, they would have been household names.
Well, they will have all been household names. No, totally. The grave of Marc, the grave of Brithre. And this is a crucial bit. This is where Arthur comes into the standards of the grave. The grave of Marc, the grave of Brithre, the grave of Gwyrion Glegethryd. A mystery to the world, the grave of Arthur. So Arthur's grave is not known yet.
They all need the Black Book.
Yeah.
And the Eagle and Arthur.
Yeah, these all come from the Black Book. Come on, then.
Is there nothing for the stanzas of the grave with a photograph book with lots of them, identified in Wales?
Yeah. I'm just going to read you two verses of something called The Greetings to the Little Pig. This is by from Merlin, later called Merlin, when he is wandering in the wilderness of the woods. Listen, O little pig, happy little pig, do not go rooting on the top of the mountain, but stay here, secluded in the wood, hidden from the dogs of Rhydderch the faithful. I will prophesy, it will be truth. From above Taradir, the Cymry will be bound under one warlike leader. His name is Llywelyn of the line of Gwynedd, usurpers of the Prydain he will overcome. Listen, little pig, we shall hide from the huntsmen of Mordai, lest we be pursued and discovered. If we escape, I'll not complain of fatigue. I shall predict from the back of the ninth wave the truth about the White One who rode David to exhaustion, who built a church for those that only half believed in the upland region and among wild beasts. Until Canaan comes, nothing will be restored. And one final one. The dialogue of Gwyddawgar Hanhir at Gwynabnydd. Bull of conflict was he, active in dispersing an arrayed army, the ruler of hosts, indisposed to anger, blameless and pure of his conduct in protecting life. Against the hero, stout was his advance, the ruler of hosts, disposer of wrath, There will be protection for thee since thou askest. Where you have given me protection, how warmly were you welcomed, the hero of hosts. From what region do you come? I come from battle and conflict with shield in my hand. Broken is the helmet by the pushing of spears. I will address you, exalted man, with your shield in distress. What is your descent? Hound-hoofed is my horse, the torment of battle. Whilst I am called Gwyn, the son of Nidh, the lover of Cwylid, the daughter of Clydd. And so the Gwyn though responds, since it is thou, Gwyn, and a proud man, from you there is no concealing. I am Gwydir Garhannir. He will not leave me in parley with thee by the bridle as is becoming, but he will hasten away to his home in the Tawi. But it is not the nearest Tawi I speak of here, but the furthest Tawi. Eagle, I will call the furious sea to ebb. Polished is my ring, golden my saddle, bright to my sadness. Golden my saddle and bright. To my sadness, I saw the conflict before Caerfyrddin. Before Caerfyrddin, a host I saw. Shields were shattered and ribs broken. Renowned and splendid was he who made the assaults. Gwyn ap Nidh, the hope of armies, sooner would legions fall before the hooves of your horses than broken rushes to the ground. Handsome my dog and round-bodied, truly the best of dogs, Dormach was he who belonged to Maeglin. Dormach with the ruddy nose, what a gazer you are upon me because I notice your wanderings on Gwibvir Vineyard. I have been in the place who has killed Gwynoddli, the son of Caedaw, the pillar of songs, when the ravens screamed over blood. I have been in the place where Bran was killed, the son of Gwered, of far-extending fame, when the ravens of the battlefield screamed. I have been where Chlachai was slain, the son of Arthur, extolled in songs, when the ravens screamed over blood. I have been where Meirig was killed, the son of Cairian, of honourable fame, when the ravens screamed for flesh. I have not been where Gwachlech was killed, the son of Goholeth, accomplished, the resister of Floiger, that's English, the son of Chenewig. I have been where the soldiers of Prydain were slain, from the east to the north. I am alive, they in their graves. I have been where the soldiers of Prydain were slain, from the east to the south. I am alive, they in death. So this is a whole segment, category. These are some of the earliest written references you get to Arthur. Now we don't expect you to understand all that. We're going to explore that, but you just get the flavour of it. Quite a different world, and you get these fleeting references to Arthur, and you get interesting references sometimes to Arthur and the Wall, and there are echoes within some of this material of a much earlier Romano-British thing, but it's filtered through many kind of later layers, even in this early kind of tradition.
The wall thing,
yes.
Because I don't know if you saw that it was quite some years ago, there was a programme, I think it was by good Alice Roberts. They tried to find out whether there was evidence, archaeological evidence of this battle with Arthur, and they couldn't find any.
Which battle are you talking about, Lily?
This particular war, this great war that Arthur was supposed to have held. So I wonder whether is it an archetypal war rather than an actual one?
Yeah,
it's the Battle of Badon Hill, isn't there, is the famous one.
Well, there's a whole... No,
there's 12 battles.
Right, we'll go down the rabbit hole if we do that. I don't have time to respond to that properly, Ollie, because there's a lot within that question. One of the points often is there is archaeological evidence of some things, not of others. We will again explore this when we explore this territory step by step. Can't get into it now because I just want to give you a kind of flavour of the kind of early material, and then I'm going to read you a little bit of Thomas Malory to give you, because that takes us right into the medieval things. So here is another So one of the very the poem of the porter that I read you that comes in the Black Book of Carmarthen, we also find in the Red Book of Hergest later, in the 13th century Red Book of Hergest. And this is just one of the, again, very early as well. It's in a 13th century book. It's probably a very early story. It's the story of how the hero Cilwch won Olwen, which is a story really of how the son of light unites with the daughter of light. Again, we'll talk about it later on, not this weekend, but I just again want to show you the dialogue. So what happens is Cilwch comes before Arthur's court, and so Cilwch now is talking to the gatekeeper, the porter, just like Arthur was in the Black Book of Carmarthen. And Cilwch says to come to the court, and he says, I'll just read this. So Cilwch is riding towards Arthur's court, and it's a beautiful description of this powerful archetypal figure of the Son of Light. The boy went off on a steed with a gleaming grey head, 4 winters old, well-jointed stride, shell-like hooves, and a tubular gold bridle bit in its mouth, with a precious gold saddle beneath him, 2 sharp spears of silver in his hand. He had a battle axe in his hand, the length of the forearm of a full-grown man from ridge to edge. It would draw blood from the wind. It would be swifter than the swiftest dewdrop from the stalk to the ground when the dew is heaviest in the month of June. He had a gold-hinted sword on his thigh, and its blade is of gold, with a gold-chased shield, the colour of heaven's lightning, and its rim is of ivory. There were 2 spotted, white-breasted greyhounds in front of him, with a collar of red gold around the neck of each, from shoulder swell to ear. The one on the left side would run to the right side, the one on the right side would run to the left side, like 2 sea swallows swooping around him. His steed's 4 hooves would cut out 4 clods like 4 swallows in the air, above him, sometimes in front of him, sometimes behind him. Now you've got a spiral motion going in front of him, you've also got a motion, circular motion going up and down, right? So this is a cosmological image. He had a purple faux-cornered cloak about him with a ruby gold ball at each corner. Each ball was worth 100 cows. Precious gold in his buskins and stirrups from the top of his thigh to the tip of his toe was worth 300 cows. Not even the tip of a hair on him stirred, so light with his steed's canter beneath him on his way to Arthur's court. The boy said, "Is there a gatekeeper?" The gatekeeper, "There is, and as for you, may you lose your head for asking. I am gatekeeper to Arthur each first day of January, but I have deputies for the rest of the year. Open the gate." "No, I won't." "Why won't you open it?" "Knife has gone into meat and drink into horn, and a thronging in the hall of Arthur. Apart from the son of the lawful king of a country, of a craftsman who shall bring his craft, none will be allowed to answer. Allowed to enter. You shall have food for your dogs and corn for your horse and hot peppered chops for yourself and wine bringing over. Food for 50 shall be brought to you in the hostel. Tomorrow in the morning when the gate is open for the crowd has come here, for you the gate shall be open first, and you may sit wherever you wish in Arthur's hall from its upper to its lower." The boy said, "I will do none of that. If you open the gate, well and good. If not, I will bring dishonour on your lord and give you a bad name. And I will raise 3 shouts at the entrance of this gate that will be no less audible on the top of Pengawedd in Cornwall, as at the bottom of Dinsol in the north and Isau Goffel in Ireland. And all the women of this court that are pregnant shall miscarry, and those that are not, their wombs shall become heavy within them, so they shall never be with child henceforth. Glewed Galafri," which is the figure we find in the other poem, "said, however much you shout against the laws of Arthur's court, you shall not be allowed in till I go and speak with Arthur first. And Glewed came into the hall. Arthur said to him, 'You have news from the gate?' 'I do.' 2/3 of my life have gone, and 2/3 of your own. I was once in Karsi and Asi, in Sach and Salach, in Lotar and Fotar. I was once in India the Great and India the Lesser. I was once in the Battle of the Two Unnesses, when the 12 hostages were taken from Norway. And once I was in Europe, I was in Africa and the islands of Corsica, and in Caer Brithwick and Brathwick and Nevthwick. I was there when you killed the warband of Gleis, son of Merin, when you killed Amildun, son of Dugum. I was there when you conquered Greece in the east. I was once in Caeroeth and Annoeth, and in Caer Nevri Naudant. Fair kindly men did we see there, but I never in my life saw a man as handsome as the one who is at the gate at this moment. There's a whole, it goes on and on, there's a whole Arthurian world in there, because it leads into the great boar hunt and in the finding of the Hallows. Again, we'll come to that. So again, just get the feeling of that kind of, and notice in that text, he's talking about Corsica, he's talking about Greece. We're not talking about a small world here, we're a world in communion. And now, Thomas Malory. It befell in the days of Uther Pendragon, when he was king of all England, and so reigned, that there was a mighty duke in Cornwall that held war against him long time, and this duke was called the Duke of Tintagel. And so, by means, King Uther sent for this duke, charging him to bring his wife with him, for she was called a fair lady and passing wise, and her name was called Igraine. So when the duke and his wife were come unto the king, by the means of great lords they were accorded both. The king liked and loved this lady well, and he made them great cheer out of measure, and desired to have lain with her. But she was a passing good woman, and would not assent unto the king. And she sold the duke, her husband, and said, I suppose we were sent for, that I should be dishonoured. Wherefore, husband, I counsel you, that we depart from hence suddenly, that we may ride all night unto our own castle. And in likewise, she said, so they departed. Neither the king nor the council were aware of their departing. And soon as King Uther knew of their departing, so suddenly he was wondrously wroth. And he called to him his privy council, and he told them of the sudden departing of the duke and his wife. Then they advised the king to send for the duke and his wife by a great charge, and if he will not come at your summons, then you may do your best, and you have cause to make mighty war upon him. So that was done, and the messengers had their answers, and this was shortly, that neither he nor his wife would come at him. Then was the king wonderously wroth. And then the king sent him plain word again, and bade him be ready and stuff him and garnish him, for within 40 days he would fetch him out of the biggest castle that he hath. And when the king duke had this warning, anon he went and furnished and garnished 2 strong castles of his, of which the one hight Tintagel and the other hight Terrible. And so his wife Dame Igraine he put in the castle of Tintagel, and himself he put in the castle of Terrible, which had many issues and posted gates. Then in haste came Uther with a great host, and led a siege around the castle of Terrible. And there he pight many, many, many pavilions. There was great war made on both parties, and many people slain. Then for pure anger, and for great love of fair Igraine, King Uther fell sick. And so came to the king Uther Sir Ulfius, a noble knight, and asked the king why he was sick. I shall tell thee, said the king, I am sick for anger and for love of fair Igraine, that I may not be whole. Well, my lord, said Sir Ulfius, I shall seek Merlin, and he shall do you remedy, that your heart shall be pleased. So Ulfius departed, and by adventure he met Merlin in a beggar's array. And there Merlin asked Ulfius whom he sought. And he said he had little ado to tell him. Well, said Merlin, I know whom you seekest, and seek no further, for I am he. And if King Uther would well reward me, and be sworn unto me to fulfil my desire, this shall be his honour, and shall profit more than mine, for I shall cause him to have all his desire. All this will I undertake, said Ulfius, and there shall be nothing reasonable but you shall have your desire. Well, said Merlin, he shall have his intent and desire. Therefore, said Merlin, ride on your way, I will not be long behind. Now you can hear the completely different tone of this. Now in between this book and those books, we have the writings of Geoffrey of Monmouth and various other writings, but the bridging writings, in particular the History of the Kings of Britain and the Vita Merlini, both of which you have in your packs. So you have don't have the whole of the history, you have the Prophecy of Merlin, and you have the History of the Life of Merlin. And these are the two bridging documents between the very early tradition and this later medieval tradition. So if I finish this bit entirely, I'm going to read you 20th century version written by Charles Williams. And this is a poem called The Crowning of Arthur. The king stood crowned, around in the gates, midnight striking, torches and fires massing the colour, casting the metal, furnace of jubilee through time and town. Logres heraldically flaunted the king's state. The lords sheathed their swords, they camped by Camelot's wall. Thick tossed torches, tall candles flared, open, deployed. Between them rose the beasts of the banners, flaring over all the king's dragon ramped. Wars were at an end. The king's friend stood at the king's side. Lancelot's lion had roared in the pattern the king's mind cherished, in charges completing the strategy of Arthur, the king's brain working in Lancelot's blood. Presaging intelligence of time climbed. Merlin climbed through the dome of Stephen, over chimneys and churches. From the point of Camelot he looked through the depth to the dome of Sophia. The kingdom, the power and the glory chimed. He turned with the fires amid burning mail, poured, tributaried by torches and candles, to a point in a massive of colour, one aureole flame, the first shield deep azure, sidereally pointed of the Lord Percivale. Driving back that azure, a sea rose black. On a fess of argent rode a red moon. The Queen Morgause leaned from a casement. Her forehead's moon swallowed the fires. It was crimson of the bright banded sable of Lamorak. The tincture changed, ranged the craft of the king's new champion in a crimson field. Mockery in mockery, a dolphin ninant, a silver fish under bloody waters. Conquering or conquered, Dinadan laughed. A pelican in golden piety struck well, the triple bloody drops from its wound. In strong nurture of instinct, it smote for its young its breast. The shield of Bors bore its rich fervours to itself most fell. Shouldering shapes through the skies rise and run through town and time, Merlin beheld the beasts of Brocelande, the fish of Nimue, hierarchic republican, the glory of Logres, the patterns of the Logos in the depth of the sun. Taliesin and the crowd beheld the compelled brutes, wildness formalized, images of mathematics, star and moon, dolphin and pelican, lion and leopard changing their measure. Over the mob's noise rose gushing the sound of the flutes. Gawain's thistles, Bedivere's rose drew near, flutes infiltrating the lights of candles. Through the magical sound of the fire-strewn air, spirit, burning to sweetness of body, exposed in the midst of its bloom the young Queen Guinevere. Lancelot moved to descend, the king's friend kneeled, the king's organic motion, the king's mind's blood, the lion in the blood roaring through the mouth of creation as the lions roar that stand in the Byzantine glory. Guinevere's chalice flew red on an argent field. So in Lancelot hand she came through the glow into the king's mind, who stood to look at his city. The king made for the kingdom, or the kingdom made for the king. Thwart drove his current against the current of Merlin. In beleaguered Sophia they sang of the dolorous blow. Doom in shock sprinkled the burning gloom, molten metals and kindling colours pouring into the pyre. At the zenith, lion and dragon rose, clawed, twisted, screamed. Taliesin beheld a god lie in his tomb. At the door of the gloom, sparks die and revive. The spark of Logris fades, glows, fades. It is the first watch. The Pope says matins in Lateran. The hollow call is beaten on the board in Sophia. The ledge of souls shudders, whether they live or die. Much of that you probably don't understand, but again, just get the feeling of it. Again, we will look at Charles Williams' very particular vision of Arthur in our time. So in a certain sense, what I've just done really is just an enormously condensed canter through some of the layers of the palimpsest that is Arthur and Arthurian tradition. All of that has particular meaning to particular times, to particular events. And so when we look at this ancient but ever-renewing tradition, we come back to this sense of the working with the tradition, where we encounter it and make it know in our own flesh, in our own understanding, in our own expression, linking its story to our story. And in a certain sense, being both the grail seeker and the grail keeper.